I'd like to turn to Leviticus 29. I want to read a couple of verses to you. Leviticus 29. If you remember, Leviticus is one of the five books of Moses, and it sets forth, among other things, it sets forth the requirements that God set forth in what is sometimes referred to as the Mosaic Law. It was the requirements that God placed upon His chosen people, who in the Old Testament was the Jews, or the nation of Israel, really, more specifically. But one of the things that I liked about this is, as I was thinking about Thanksgiving this week, you know, which we had on Thursday, and I was kind of thinking about that. And of course, Thanksgiving is a day when we give thanks to the Lord for His providence. I came across these verses, and they were kind of humorous, but I thought they were kind of neat. If you come down to the end of chapter 22 of Leviticus at verse 29, it says, "And when ye will offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving unto the Lord, offer it at your own will." Even in these days, from time to time, if somebody was filled with joy and thanksgiving, they were grateful to God for their many blessings, they would have a meal. They'd perform a sacrifice, and they would invite their friends or their family, and they would eat a meal. And that's one of the reasons why we in this nation have, first by presidential proclamation, and then later by legislation, making it a national holiday, it's a day of thanksgiving. Now, I know that a lot of times if you watch the news, they're not going to come out and say, "Hey, we're giving thanks to God," because, you know, God forbid we should actually mention who we're giving thanks to. But obviously, when we talk in terms of being grateful, we talk in terms of being thankful, when we talk in terms of having, you know, looking to providence and being grateful to God for His blessings upon our nation and upon our communities and on our families and so on, we're grateful to God, the God of the universe, the God who is the Father of the Lord Jesus Christ. So it's kind of neat, you know. You don't go to a Thanksgiving meal and you're begrudging, you know. You're not, maybe if you're eight, you know, you have to go if you don't want to go. But as an adult, the only kind of Thanksgiving that God's going to accept is one where we give it of our own free will. You know, we do it as a voluntary offering to Him, and we're rejoicing in that. But then look at verse 30. It says, "On the same day it shall be eaten up. Ye shall leave none of it until the morrow. I am the Lord." Okay, so under the law, they didn't get leftovers. Okay, you know, they didn't get leftovers. They had to eat it all. Excuse me. They had to eat it all on that day, and then just, you know, burn the rest so they didn't have it. But I'm thankful to say that we are under grace, and we're no longer under the law, so it's perfectly fine if you want to have turkey sandwiches and other things for the coming days. There's no problem there. So I thought that was kind of funny. But we do enjoy our Thanksgiving season, and it is a time sort of introspection. It's a time as we come to the end of the year. We have sort of this holiday series. Excuse me. We go through Halloween, and we all are excited about it being the fall, and then suddenly, you know, it's Thanksgiving, and then we're putting lights up on the house, maybe, or putting, you know, Santa Claus, and all of that is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, we're kind of in the Christmas spirit, in the Christmas season, which I'm grateful for. I realize there's a lot of commercialization. Of course there is. But still, nevertheless, the world is celebrating the birth of the Lord Jesus Christ, which is obviously very something to be thankful for. And then after that, we kind of roll through the new year, and we start, you know, over with another year. We made it another time around the sun. But I hope that as we go through this season, that we approach it properly, that we look back at the blessings that God has given us. Look at, you know, we've come through some sorrow, obviously, but we've also come through some joy. And we ought to be introspective and maybe take a look at our lives like I've been doing and just try to say, okay, what went well? What didn't go so well? What were the things that I should have done better? You know, where are the times whenever I just stepped out and did stuff? Where are the times when I really went to the Lord, you know, for guidance and so on? And that is really helpful. That kind of renewal is something that we all need and will never outgrow. So I personally am very thankful, very thankful that it is Thanksgiving weekend. And it's been many years, but those of you who know me, that in years past, I would often give you a Thanksgiving message. I would speak on the book of Esther. And I got to tell you, I had another subject that I've been looking at all week and last, you know, and but this morning, I was looking at this book going, what is this stuff? It didn't make any sense to me at all. And I prayed to the Lord, and I trust it's of His direction that it's on my heart to share with you once again the beautiful story of the book of Esther. And like I said, like anytime we read the Bible, we always got to look at it through a lens of Jesus Christ. This isn't just a historical story. This isn't just something interesting, but rather, ultimately, God is teaching us lessons that we can have and we should pay attention to in our lives as we walk as followers of the Lord Jesus Christ. Real briefly, let's begin our story on the book of Esther, which is the story of the Jewish Thanksgiving. It's actually the origin of a celebration that they have every spring, early spring. Usually it's, what, February, usually? So it's at the end of their year. And it's called Purim. Okay, and this dates back to the days of the Persian Empire. Now, the book of Esther is a very interesting book. I guess you could say that about all of the 66 books that are in the Bible. But this is an interesting book because the name of God is not actually mentioned anywhere in the book. Okay, it's not mentioned anywhere in the book of Esther. And nevertheless, as we will go through it, and if the Lord will bless us, we'll see His hand on every page. In other words, one of the things that we might not think about as often as we should is when we read the Bible, we read about the ministry of the Lord Jesus Christ, and we read about the miracles that He performed, whether it was calming the winds and the waves, or healing someone who was sick, or providing food for the masses, as He did on a couple of occasions. Or we go back in the Old Testament and likewise read about men such as Moses who did certain, you know, miracles and signs and wonders, or Elijah, or others. You know, it's you might get the mistaken impression that if you lived in the Bible times, it would be common for you to see a miracle like that. And the answer is actually that the opposite is true. There's very few, relatively speaking, individuals who actually did signs and wonders. They were a special sign on the part of God under extraordinary circumstances. Most of the time, most of the people you're going to read about, whether they lived in the Old Testament or they lived in the New, had lives pretty much like ours. Now, they didn't have automobiles. They did not have cell phones. I get that. Set that technology aside. But what they did have is they had friends, and they had jobs, and they had frustrations, and they had kids who may or may not be doing what they're, you know, supposed to be doing. They had the same kinds of issues that we go to. And they had times when they had doubts. They had times when they had sorrow. And there were times when they had joy. And so as we go through the book of Esther, even though it's in a different place and a different time, and we'll point out some of the different cultural things that are relevant to us, I want you to understand that the providence that God has and displays in this story is just as true to us today. And we should be thankful for that. Now, I ask you to go to Daniel chapter 11 for these reasons. This is one of the most interesting and fascinating prophecies in all the Bibles, Daniel chapter 11. In fact, so much so that those who deny the scriptures will say that this could not have possibly been written by Daniel, who lived about 500 BC or so, 530, 550, that in that time frame, because it's just too accurate. It spells out the next 200 or 300 years of history, this period of time between the Old Testament and the New. And a lot of the skeptics and the scoffics and the unbelievers out here say, well, obviously, since prophecy cannot happen, since miracles can't happen, since there is no God or whatever the foolish reasoning is that clearly this was all written down later. Well, I'm here to tell you that it wasn't written down later. This was all given by God, and it's very interesting in how accurate it really is. And God gives us evidence for us to confirm our faith. And if you'll just believe it, But here in chapter 11, this is a prophecy that Daniel receives from the angel Gabriel. And it says, also I, this is the angel speaking, also I in the first year of Darius, you can also say Darius, Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. And let me go ahead and keep reading. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those. Now, what's interesting here is in a very short verses, the Lord is showing what's going to happen over the next couple of hundred years. That he says, right now you've got your first king of Persia. This is King Cyrus the Great. He's named by name in the book of Isaiah, hundreds of years before he was born. He says, you got a king now. He says, there's going to be three more kings after him of the Persians. And this was in the first year of Darius the Mede. So Daniel was, this was about 538 BC. He says, there's going to be three more kings that come after that of the Persians. No, kings of the Medes, kings of the Persians. And then there'll be a fourth king who will be greater than them all. He'll be richer than them all. And this fourth king of the Persians is going to be so wealthy and so righteous that he's going to stir up the Greeks, the Hellenes, the Greeks, like a hornet's nest. Okay? And then after that, there's going to be a king, which is obviously a king of the Greeks, who's going to come back and seek vengeance upon that. And then when he dies, he's not going to have any heirs. Instead, his kingdom is going to be divided. Now, who we're talking about, obviously, is we're talking about, first of all, we're talking about the three kings who came after Cyrus the Great. These are Cambyses, and there's a guy named Pseudo-Smerdis, and then there's this guy named Darius or Darius the Great. And then those are the three kings of the Persians. History tells us all about that. And then the fourth one is somebody you've certainly heard of, Xerxes the Great. Remember the movie 300? It came out a few years ago. Now, he's not this big black, you know, sexually androgynous black guy, you know, 7 foot tall. That's not him. He was a dumpy white guy, okay, with a beard. But because the Persians were white. But anyway, that's Xerxes the Great. And he's the one who invaded Greece. Remember the story of the Battle of Thermopylae? We're going to get to that in a minute because this is in the Bible here. And the Spartans and the Athenians withstood them in that narrow pass there for a while. Now, the Persians were successful. They were able to come in and conquer Athens and make a lot of leeway. But eventually, the Greeks were able to beat them back. Okay, they were ultimately defeated. And what's interesting about that is those took place in the 470, 480 BC time frame. What's fascinating about that is about 150 years later, as you know, Alexander the Great, who was the son of Philip of Macedon or Macedon, he's the one who went and actually conquered the Persian Empire. That's who we're talking about. It says there's going to be three kings among the Persians. There'll be a fourth king who's greater than them all. That's the king we're going to learn about in the book of Esther, by the way. Xerxes the Great is the king in there. And then later on, Alexander the Great's going to come. So that's, isn't that interesting? This is how Bible prophecy works. This is given to us not for just our knowledge or interest. It's not just a factoid, but rather it's showing us that God truly does direct history. I'm not saying that everything that happens, God causes, right? But what I'm saying is that God does know what's going to happen. He's watching it happen. He's outside of time, so he sees us right now, just like he sees Alexander the Great on the battlefields. But nevertheless, he tells us what is going to happen, and he directs through his providence. Okay, and I've used that term several times now, and I want to just kind of remind you, we live in a nation where we talk about the providence of God. It's in our Declaration of Independence, right? But what providence really means is God's providing for his creation and more specifically for his people. God is a good God. I'm going to say one more thing and then we're going to get into the book of Esther. And I'm sorry about that, but this is, like I said, this is what's on my mind and my heart. I was talking with David Piles, you know, he's a minister down in Jackson, and he said that he saw the recent C.S. Lewis movie I don't know if y'all saw that or not. It's based on a play. You know, remember C.S. Lewis was an English author, and he was a don, and he was at Oxford and Cambridge, right? Okay. And he went from being an atheist to being a theist to being a Christian, a believer in Jesus Christ. And he had a great impact on a lot of people, obviously, if you've read the Narnia series, or you read the Screwtape Letters, or Mere Christianity. He was very prolific, and I encourage you to read his writings. But he said that as he went along, I'm paraphrasing it, as he went along, the question that he was asking was, is there a God? Okay, is there a God? But he realized after a while that that wasn't the correct question. The question is not, is there a God? The question is, does he care? Does he care about us? You know, is he just some God who created things and then went his way? Or is he involved in his creation? Does he care about us? Yes. Is he a personal God that actually cares about you and me and all of us? And the answer is yes, he is. And we're going to see this in the book of Esther. So I want you to understand that God, the God of the Bible, the God of creation, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, cares about us. And he sent his Son to die for us. And that ought to give us hope. And we ought to use that as strength to put up with all the crap that we're having to put up with. And all the crazy people in our lives, not like spouses and things. Okay, just tell Cindy I said that. But just the people that are out here. And sometimes we're that person. We need to have a heavenly perspective. And the book of Esther will help us do that. So that was a long, lengthy introduction. I'll give you the time on the back, but I'd rather you understand why we're talking about this and then go through it. Because you can read the book just like I can, and I'm not going to read it all to you. But this, I'm going to propose to you, and I'm going to submit to you, that as we go through the book of Esther, it's about 482 B.C., and Xerxes the Great is the king. Now, he goes by the title Ahasuerus, but Ahasuerus is a... It's an office. It's not a proper name. It's like Caesar. You know, Caesar was the emperor in Rome. Caesar Augustus. You know, Caesar Titus. You know, at different times. Pharaoh, same thing. Pharaoh in England, in Egypt. Pharaoh was the name of the king, but that was his title. It was Pharaoh Ramses. Pharaoh somebody else. So here Ahasuerus is the king. This is Xerxes the First. So let's read a few verses here. It says, now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, and then parenthetically, it says, this is Ahasuerus which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces. So this is at the height of the Persian Empire, and that's how we know that it's Xerxes the Great. It says that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all of his princes and his servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 180 days, for 180 days, for 6 months, he convenes an extended meeting with all of his officials, all of the governors of these 127 provinces, all of his noblemen, all of his counselors. They're up to something. They're planning something. And then it says, and when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace, where there were white, green, and blue hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple and silver rings of pillar and marble. The beds were of gold and silver and a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse one from another, and royal wine in abundance according to the state of the king. And the drinking was according to the law, none did compel. So the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. And it says, and also Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged or abutted to that of King Ahasuerus. That's what that means. Okay, so let me just give you a quick rundown here. What's going on is, as I said, for 6 months, there's a a conference, if you want to call it. The king has called people in, and I'm going to submit to you that what was going on during this conference was they were planning logistically and everything else. They were raising the army necessary to go conquer the Hellenes, that is, the Greeks. Okay, this is what's going on, and obviously Herodotus and other historians tell us that he had over 1 million men in his army, boats and ships and everything else. And this would have taken quite a bit of time to organize and put together. And I'm going to submit to you that that's what's going on. Regardless, there's this 6 month period of time. At the end of it, at the conclusion of it, the king is in a good mood, obviously. It looks like everything's going to plan. And he has a special 7 day wine festival there in the city, Shushan, the palace. This was the capital of the Persian Empire. I can't remember if it's in modern-day Iran or Iraq. I think it's up in Iran, but the site is still there. They found all of these things, indications. They found the palace that these things took place in, the archaeologists have. But the point of the 7 day feast was to celebrate it, to invite the people, you know, that lived there in the palace and worked in the palace. They came together, and for 7 days they kind of had an Oktoberfest. Okay, you know, where everybody got together, and the king did not require you to drink, but if you wanted to drink wine, you wanted to have food, it was kind of a celebration, kind of an employee party, maybe, I guess you could think of. But here's this 7 days. Now, this is the significance of this, is that at this time, the king is getting a little bit loaded. We're going to learn about the king, this pagan king, Xerxes the Great. He has many fine qualities, but he also has many bad qualities. One of the things we're going to find out is that he's an absolute tyrant. He has the absolute power of life and death over all of his subjects. He can command them to be put to death, and they're immediately put to death. And he is an absolute ruler and authority figure over all. He also has a very beautiful wife by the name of Vashti. And as we continue reading on, you can read the verses, but I'll just summarize it for you, if you will. On the seventh day, he, in sort of a little bit of a drunken stupor, he wants to show off his wife. His wife is showing appropriate propriety. All the women, all the wives, all the people are having their separate party in separate chambers. This was a very misogynistic kind of society, very patriarchal society. And so all the women were kind of off by themselves. These were all the men were here. And no doubt they're starting to boast about how beautiful their wives are and all of this and that. And so the king says, hey, he speaks to his chamberlains, his eunuchs, okay, because those are the only men who are allowed in the harem, right? Go get Vashti and have her appear so I can show off her beauty. And some at least say, possibly they might have said, I want her to come just wearing her crown and nothing else. So, you know, it's to display her beauty. You can see that whether that part of it is true, it's clear that he didn't think much of her as a person, because, you know, that was obviously kind of a humiliating thing. I mean, I know it's always nice to you want people to meet your spouse or something like that, but you don't put them on display, you know. Hey, look how hot my girlfriend is, you know. I mean, that's, and maybe you do that when you're 20. But, you know, hopefully when you're the king of Persia, you wouldn't do that. So clearly the king is in the wrong here. And Vashti refuses. And that poured a huge damper on this entire party, because suddenly nobody says no to the king, even the queen. And at this point, we see some machinations that take place, some palace intrigue, which was very, very common among, well, all ancient societies, in fact, all current societies. You know, Washington is full of this kind of intrigue where people are vying for power and everything else. There's seven different men who are his counselors, and one of them in particular who might have had a grudge against Vashti or who knows, you know, what was going on. But he says, you know, king, this is worse than you think. The king was kind of miffed that she wouldn't come, and so he says, well, what should I do, you know? And one of them stands up and says, you know what you ought to do? You gotta divorce her. You gotta kick her out. You gotta, you know, lock her away in a tower somewhere and never see her again. And you need to publish a proclamation throughout all the land that says that because Queen Vashti did not come when I said, I've kicked her out. I've taken everything away from her. You know, because what the guy says is, if you don't do this, if you don't get your women under control, okay, then they're all going to get uppity, and there's going to be confusion throughout the land. Now, Let me just say this, ladies in particular, okay? When the Bible tells us something that's going on, sometimes it's not approving of it. I just want to make sure you understand that. The Bible tells us, for example, that Judas Iscariot went out and hanged himself. You know, that doesn't mean you're supposed to do it. That doesn't mean that was the right thing to do. It's just there. The Bible tells us things that happen. When Peter denied the Lord three times, I'm not saying that was a good thing, all right? And he wept bitterly, but it tells us what happened. And so this is what happened, okay? So don't be mad at me and don't be mad at your husband. We're not going to do that, okay? But nevertheless, that's what was done. And so they sent this notice throughout all the land. And that concludes chapter 1. There's a gap between chapter 1 and chapter 2. I'm just going to read little sections so we can follow this. And remember, the subject is how God is working behind the scenes. God does not require us to do anything in particular for Him to bring about His purposes. Okay? God has a million different ways that He can get things done with or without you. Really, when we think about obeying God, the reason we obey God is not to help Him out. But I think we can all say from experience that when we do what God has told us to do, it's not nearly as painful. It's not nearly a painful path as when we go out and try to do things on our own. Okay, God is not thwarted by us. But it's very interesting and very curious to me that God wasn't involved. God didn't cause, King Xerxes to be a jerk. Okay, I mean, that's on Xerxes. God didn't tell Vashti to not show up. She could have shown up. God can still do what He's going to do. You see what I'm saying? Your salvation and your happiness and your ultimate security with God does not depend upon you or me or anything out here happening. It depends upon Jesus Christ coming and doing exactly what he accomplished on the cross. And that ought to make you feel good. Okay? Don't put so much pressure on yourself. Let's try to do good, but this world is a mess. And it's always been a mess. It was a mess in these days. So I know I'm kind of editorializing here, maybe a little bit too much annotation, but I want you to think about the practical lessons of this story. And I will hurry along, okay? So, it now says in chapter 2 that it says, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus, that's Xerxes, was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. And again, I believe this. I've shared this with you many a time. Many historians believe that what's happening here in chapter 2 is, this is now a couple of years later. What happened is these things happened before King Xerxes and the armies invaded Greece. He's now had his butt kicked, okay? He's now had to come home. He didn't get to expand his kingdom further. He already covered 127 provinces all the way from India to Ethiopia, down there in Africa. He wanted to expand into Europe. The Hellenes said no. God ultimately said no. I think God gave them the victory, not for their benefit, but for His, because God had already shown them what was going to happen. The Greeks would come after the Persians. But nevertheless, he's now kind of sad. He's come back and he's in a more pensive mood. And he remembers Vashti, and he remembers in his wrath that he had divorced her, and he had made a decree that said that I can never see her again. She can never cast her eyes upon me. I will never deal with her again. And that's one of the interesting things about the Medes and the Persians is that they placed an extraordinarily high amount of emphasis on telling the truth. Okay? We might think that we as a nation do that. Think about two of our most notable presidents. One is George Washington and the other was Abe Lincoln. When we think about these men, and I'm not talking about the people that are tearing down their statues. I'm talking about normal people like us. When we think about George Washington, they say, the old lesson is that he chopped down a cherry tree and his father asked him who chopped down the cherry tree. And he says, well, Father, I cannot tell a lie. I chopped it down. That is made up, but his reputation for absolute honesty and integrity was not. It was a marvel of the world. I mean, George Washington really did take seriously trying to speak well. I mean, he was a good dude. And Abe Lincoln the same way. There's a story that he once got extra change. It was a small amount, but he walked miles to return it because it was just right. So there are vestiges of that in our culture, and I wish there was more. We all ought to be honest people. We ought to be like that. It's very important that you be honest. But here's the thing. We have nothing compared to how the Persians were about. I mean, the Persians were so intense about this that they would not even speak something unless they knew it was the truth. And this had some to do with their goddesses and gods and things like that. One of the things that Xerxes said to the Greeks was that you guys are people who go to the marketplace and they tell lies one to another, right? Because remember, the Greek tradition is to go down to the marketplace and to talk, because the idea is that logos, philosophy, the understanding, the meaning of life, you can read about this in the 17th chapter of the book of Acts, where they sit there and they talk with each other and they understand that by expressing it and looking at it, and you can come up with an improvement of what is true, right? That's why the Greeks were so philosophical, the Epicureans and the Stoics and all of those groups, the Pythagoreans and all, as you look at it. But the Persians were not like that. The Persians did not do that. The Persians spoke the truth, and that's why the rule was that when the king gave an edict, he was actually speaking by and the gods through him, and even the king could not change that verdict, okay? And that explains, by the way, just to take us back, in Daniel chapter 6, we read of the story when Daniel was an old man. You guys remember the story of Daniel in the lion's den? Remember he was thrown into the lion's den overnight? Because they had fooled this Darius the Mede, the guy who was the father-in-law to Cyrus the Great, to make a proclamation that said that nobody could pray to any god or man except for you for 30 days. And Daniel, of course, continued to pray to God, and so he was thrown in the lion's den. Of course, he was saved providentially by God. But even Darius himself was bound by his own decree. He could not figure out how to change it. You look at the Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar was able to change his decree, but they're not under the Persians, and that's important. Okay? So here, I said all of that for this reason, that Ahasuerus has divorced Vashti. You might say, well, why didn't he just go and, you know, bring her up? He's the king, isn't he? Well, no, he is bound by the same rules as everybody else. And that's going to become important. So what his ministers do is they suggest that, well, what you ought to do is find a new queen, find somebody better, you know, get a young one, get a new one, you know. and so that's exactly what happens, is basically the ministers go out through all the land and they scoop up all the really, really beautiful young women, and they bring them in and they go through an extensive beauty treatment process, and they go into the king, and you know what that means. And then in the morning he tells her, hey, you can ask anything and I'll give it to you. And some would ask for diamonds, some would ask for jewels, some would ask for lands or revenues or whatever. And then they would be sent off to the harem, and then they would stay there until the king desired her again. So there were, you know, there's a lot of women getting thrown into this harem. That's where we learned this woman named Esther. Her name was Hadassah, Esther. And she's of the Jewish people. She's one of the Israelites who was carried away captive in the days of the Babylonians. She's been raised by her uncle, her cousin. Actually, it's her cousin. He's older than she is. She's been raised, because she's an orphan, she's been raised by a man named Mordecai. Mordecai is a mid-level bureaucrat. He's a very good guy. We don't know exactly what it is that he does, but he has business in the palace of Shushan. And he discovers she's young. I don't know, she's 18 or something, whatever the age is there when you can go and start, you know, being the wife of somebody. She gets recruited. You don't say no. He just tells her, go do a good job, do everything that they ask you to do, and do not reveal that you're of the nation of Israel. Don't reveal to them that you're a Jew. Again, all these people looked alike. You know, isn't that interesting? So here she is. She goes in there. Why did Mordecai do that? There was no danger. There was no anything wrong. There were no plots against the Jewish people. They were safe. I mean, if anything, the Persians were very favorable toward the Jews. Cyrus the Great had already sent them back. There's been multiple proclamations to go and repopulate Jerusalem, rebuild the city, all of that. I mean, you know, things are good. Nevertheless, and again, I'm going to say, this is just one of those things. This is how God works behind the scenes. I think God put it upon Mordecai's heart to say, hey, do not reveal to anyone that you're a Jew. Okay. And so she does. And she goes in there and she goes through the beauty treatment just like everybody else. You can continue to read this in chapter 2. And you'll find that that they go down and you know, she ultimately goes into to the king, and you know, they do their thing, and then in the morning he asks, what would you like? And she says, I don't want anything. I'm perfectly content, king. And she had said the same thing to the eunuchs and other people that were in charge of her. She was very kind and very sweet and very gracious, and she never wanted anything. And I'm going to tell you that that is very, very alluring. It was very, very alluring to this king who enjoyed making people happy by buying stuff for them or giving them things. And here's this woman who doesn't want a thing. He's obviously attracted to her. And ultimately, Esther becomes queen. She's actually elevated to the position of being queen over the entire nation. And that's really great. There's one more thing that happens here. Again, God did not direct this per se, but he did use it to his benefit. There's another interesting puzzle piece. When we think about the providence of God, think of it as a puzzle piece. There's this thing happens over here, and then there's this thing happens over here, and this thing happens down here, and then slowly, surely, they all come together. And that's how God works in your life. And that's how he works in my life. Okay? This is how things happen. God is doing stuff all the time, even if we don't perceive it. Well, there's a plot against the life of the king. There's certain chamberlains, there's certain guards who have access to the king, and they are plotting to execute, to assassinate King Xerxes. And Mordecai learns of this, and he certifies it to Esther. He sends a message, because he can't walk in on the queen either, you know, but he can speak through intermediaries, and he sends a message to Esther talking about it. There's an investigation made, and these men are in fact found to be guilty. There was in fact a plot, an assassination plot, and they're saved by it, and they make a journal entry of that account. And that's basically all we learn about, okay? Now, as we continue on, and I know we're getting sort of short on time, but let me kind of take you through what's happening next. Every good story has a bad guy. Okay, every good story has a bad guy. And the bad guy in this story's name is Haman. If you ever went to a Jewish synagogue around the time of the festival of Purim, then as they tell this story, then every time that the word Haman is mentioned, then everybody hisses. Boo! That's right, they boo. I'm not going to ask you guys to do that. But this is part of the fun of the story of and the joy of Thanksgiving. The joy of God, even in terrible times, coming together and saving the people because of his graciousness toward us. And so this Haman fellow is elevated. I'll summarize this quickly for you. But in chapter 3, we read about this man named Haman who becomes prime minister. He's second in command of the entire nation. He gains the trust of this king, who's kind of naive a little bit. He's not really paying attention to what's going on. I mean, seems like a good guy in some ways, like I said, but you know, here he is. He's not really a good judge of character because he puts Haman in charge of all of this stuff. Well, Haman is of the Amalekites, and the importance of that is he's a descendant of Esau. There's eternal enmity between the Jews and between Esau. God has said that. That doesn't mean that they couldn't be polite with one another, but they were enemies. But what Haman demanded was that everybody show him the same level of respect and obeisance and worship that the king was entitled to. So Haman would walk into a room, everybody would immediately fall down on their face, but Mordecai would just stay standing there. He would bow to him or something, but he wasn't about to do that. And some of the people who are causing trouble, and you got people like this in your life who are trying to stir up problems, they go to Mordecai and say, why aren't you bowing like the rest of us? He says, well, I'm a Jew and I'm prohibited from doing that. And so they immediately run off and tell Haman, okay, yeah, that's how people are. They're like that today. They're like that back then. You know people who have done that to you. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Anyway, Haman decides that not only is he going to kill Mordecai, he's going to wipe out all the Jews. Okay, now Satan obviously had something to do with that. There's more behind the story because there's a promised Messiah who's going to come through the Jewish people, obviously. So Satan is going to try to ultimately do a massacre. But if he can wipe out all the Jews, then the Messiah is not going to be able to come. I mean, this is the same thing that Pharaoh did back, we read about in the early chapters of the book of of Exodus, right? When all the Hebrew males were supposedly to be put to death. You can think about this in the time of Herod when the baby Jesus was born. He tried to kill him by killing all the infants in the coast of Bethlehem and so on. This is a page out of Satan's playbook. But here, what's interesting, and the reason why this holiday is called Purim, is because he actually took, I don't want to say dice, but pretend like they're dice. He took things that you cast lots to try to find the best time, the most appropriate time to carry out this massacre. That's what Haman wanted to do. And he came up with the 13th day of the 12th month, okay? The 13th day of the 12th. This is early in the year, so now we're about 6 or 8 months away from this date of massacre. And once he saw, and I might be getting the order off, but basically he's got a day when he wants to wipe out all the Jews throughout all the Persian Empire. And he goes into the king, and he tells the king, he says, "Hey, king, you've got people in your kingdom who are subversive. They don't pay taxes. They don't go along with your rules. They're troublemakers, and you need to get rid of them." And Haman actually offers to say, "Look, I will make up the cost, the difference, because of the taxes and other things that you get." And the king says, "Do whatever you want." Okay, you know, king's all about unity. King's all about us all getting along. You know, okay. And so he gives his signet to Haman. And there's this proclamation that is published throughout all the land that says, on the 13th day of the 12th month of this year, it's open season on the Jews. If you've got a neighbor who's a Jew, you can go over there and kill him and take all his stuff. And this caused confusion throughout all the land. Everybody was like, "What is going on here?" And remember what I told you earlier. When you make a proclamation like this, you can't change it. So imagine if you were living in a nation, and it's getting increasingly easier to imagine this, quite frankly, under things that have been happening in recent years and months. But imagine if there was a law that was literally passed that said, "Hey, anybody can kill a Christian if they want to." Okay, now you set it on a date on this coming November 30th. If there's a Christian out there, you can shoot them. And it's like The Purge. I don't know if you've heard of that movie or not. I haven't watched it. But, you know, the concept is here's this window of time when you can just get away with whatever you want to get away with. There's no rules. Okay. It's really that bad. I mean, it's really that awful. And you can imagine living under that. And one of the questions these people were probably saying is how in the world are we going to get out of this? I mean, what are we going to do? I mean, it's not like we can change the rule, right? But God is an expert at solving impossible problems, okay? And that's the thing I want you to remember. If things are getting increasingly dark and dank out here in the world, and you're starting to say, "How in the world is this going to happen?" Just, you know, God is going to say, "Just watch this. Just trust me. I will take care of it." And that's the message. You don't need to worry about any of this weirdness that's going on in the world, because God will handle it His way and in His time. Now, to hurry this story along, everybody was upset about this and not liking this, the fact that there's this decree. And we find that Mordecai comes to Esther. They can't talk directly. They've got to talk through intermediaries, right? Some eunuch has to come down and take a message back and then hear what they say. But I would like to direct your attention to chapter 4. And basically, you know, Esther lives such an isolated life. She doesn't even know that this proclamation has been published everywhere. But Mordecai tells her about it. And Mordecai basically says to his daughter, his adopted daughter, his cousin, says, "You got to do something." And she says, "I can't do anything. I mean, I might be the queen, but I mean, I'm just as much a prisoner and subject as the rest of you guys. Don't you remember what happened to Vashti when she, you know, did something?" He says, if I went into the king, without being called for, you know, anybody who walks in on the king in his throne room, unless he extends the staff to you and you're allowed to touch it, you're a dead man. I mean, there are people standing right there with swords and everything else. And if the king's displeased with you, you're dead. And he says, "The king hasn't called for me for 30 days. His passions toward me have cooled. I'm not sure he even likes me anymore. There's nothing I can do." You ever feel like that? Yeah? Especially when God is putting something upon you to do. Something that you read in His Word, you know, something like that. Well, look at what Mordecai says. Mordecai, then, this is verse 13 of chapter 4, says, then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, think not with thyself that thou can escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place, but thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? 2 points that Mordecai makes that are really, really good. First of all, he says, look, don't think for a moment that you're going to escape. Okay? If this destruction comes forth, you're going to be destroyed. And he says, God is going to save us. Okay? Enlargement and salvation will come from another place. In other words, Mordecai knows that God is not going to allow this to happen. He doesn't know how it's going to happen. But the hypothesis we're testing, for those of you who are a little bit more scientific here, you know, do some A-B testing here. The hypothesis that we're kind of evaluating and thinking about is maybe God's going to use Esther. Maybe her influence and her insight. Maybe, and he says not only that, he says, maybe this is why you were made queen to begin with. Maybe this is what God has called you along. Doesn't that give you some hope? I mean, none of us are going to be the queen or the king of Persia, right? But if God has raised us up to a place, have you ever thought about it? Maybe God has something planned for you. Maybe there's some big or small, something important, something for you to do. We need to remember that. If we wonder, why are we still here? What's my life worth? It's worth infinite value. Okay, it's measured by the blood of Jesus Christ. And God may use you to bring forth His glory, to help people. I mean, this is great. And he says, maybe this is the very reason why you were made queen all along. And so what she does is she hears the counsel and agrees. She says, I want you to go back with your people and you fast for 3 days and I will get with my maidens and I will fast for 3 days. And then I'm going into the king. And she says, if I perish, I perish. And that's faith. Okay. Faith is doing the best you can, thinking about the counsel of God, praying, but we're never going to have 100% clarity on what we're supposed to do, but we're trusting God. And he shows you one step at a time. And then you just say, look, this is the best I can do. I think I'm doing what God wants me to do. I'm going to do it. And then I'm just going to bear the consequences. All right. I'm just going to bear the consequences. And that's what we do. We do what God puts upon our heart. And especially in the New Testament, that's exactly what we're supposed to do. Okay. Isn't that cool? All right. They're a lot more like us than we realize. Okay. I'll hurry along the story. We're almost done. Believe it or not. Okay. So she does that in chapter 5. She gets cleaned up, she puts on her robe, she puts on her crown, she shows up at the door of it. You can imagine what she was about to say just before they opened the doors. I can do this. You know, because she doesn't know she's going to be dead in the next 5 seconds. But the doors open and the king looks up and he sees her and he's filled with love. Again, God is working behind the scenes, okay? And he extends his crown, you know, his staff to her. She walks forward and touches it. And he says, what can I do for you, my dear? Okay. And she says, if it's all right, I would like to have a party in the honor to honor Haman. I'd like to have you and Haman dine with me tonight. Okay. And he said, sure, sounds great. And when Haman hears this, he's on top of the world because I get to go have a private dinner with not only the king, but also with the queen. This is really good. And notice, Esther has never asked for anything before. So the king is like, okay, now we're cooking with gas. I mean, yeah, here's something that I can do for you. So they're happy to do that. As you continue on with this story, this is a very eventful 24 hours. Okay, God is starting to pull these pieces together. Because what happens is Haman is on top of the world. He's excited. And it just so happens that as he's leaving the palace to go home, he sees Mordecai and he is suddenly angry and depressed and sorrowful. You don't think it was God's providence that made sure that he walked by and saw Mordecai? And he did. And so Haman is now really, really upset and he comes home and he tells his wife, I'm sorrowful about this, this event. That Mordecai is still living. And so the wife says, well, what's the big deal? I mean, he's going to let you wipe out all the Jews. Why don't you just kill Mordecai? He says, that's a great idea. I'm going to do that. So, they have the feast and Mordecai, and while they're having the feast, the queen who wants to confess, She wants to ask the king to save the life of her people. She wants to she wants to accuse Haman, but there's something off. Okay, she thought maybe if we're going to have this feast, then I could bring it out. But she loses her nerve. Again, I think God is putting it up on her heart because it's not quite time yet. So what happens is the king turns to her now and says, okay, you told me that you would tell me what you want at this feast. So now what can I give you? And she says, what I'd like is I'd like a do-over. Let's meet tomorrow night and have another one of these feasts. And I'll tell you then. I think she was stalling for time. I think this young lady was bewildered and she didn't know what to do. You ever feel like that? Okay. And then things turn out okay. Okay. It's in the Bible. So anyway, like I told you, Mordecai was on top of the world because he got to have a dinner. He gets to have another dinner, but then I'm talking about Haman. Haman is on top of the world, but then he sees Mordecai and he's upset. So he tells his people to build some gallows. Now this is not gallows like you'd hang from the neck, but it's like this big tall tower that he's going to nail Mordecai's body to this thing, and it's going to be on display for the whole city. So now it's nighttime, and the king can't sleep. This is chapter 6, and this is another kind of thing where we're thinking about providence. The king has all these hot women that he could, you know, call on. I'm not trying to be indelicate, but he does. He could do anything, you know. He could have some musicians come in and play for him. I mean, you know, he's the king. But instead, he has somebody come in, and no doubt, maybe he's thinking this. He says, now, there's nothing more boring than having to listen to all the things that are going, all the chronicles of my nation. So maybe I'll listen to that, and that'll put me to sleep. I don't know. But anyway, he sits up at night, and he calls for the people who are in charge of the records, the people who write down all the things that happen in his kingdom, and he starts reading to them. So for hours and hours, here they are, you know, on such and such date, this happened. On such and such date, this happened. You know, this... You know, we made so much tax revenue. And he's like, oh, you know, this is so boring. But then, once again, by the providence of God, they come to the point where there's that record. Remember what I told you a few years ago, that Mordecai had saved the life of the king? Okay. Well, he reads it. On such and such date, 2 or 3 years ago, whatever it was, Mordecai, who works in the palace, informed Queen Esther of this plot against the king. It was found out. The two men were found guilty, and they were put to death. And here the king says, well, what did we do for Mordecai? And they look through there and say, well, we didn't do anything for Mordecai. And now, remember the king's disposition. The king wants everybody to like him. The king wants everybody to, to protect him and buy into this stuff. Obviously, it's in the king's own best interest to honor Mordecai. And so at this point in the morning, it's early now, and here is Haman outside the door. He wants to come in and ask the king if it's okay if he goes and kills Mordecai. Haman's expecting the answer to be yes. Obviously, you know, the king does everything I want him to do. Here's the king, though, by the providence of God, he's thinking about how to honor Mordecai. You guys are under no danger at all. It's all illusory. You are safe in the hands of God. Okay. Not saying that you might not, you know, have to, you know, get stabbed or something, but you're safe. And you don't understand how God protects his people. Here he's protecting Mordecai. So the king wants to honor Mordecai at the exact same time that Haman wants to kill him. They have a meeting, and this is really cool. He's the king, so the king gets to go first. And so the king says, what would you do if you had somebody in your kingdom that you wanted to honor? And of course, you know, Haman's thinking, well, who else would he be talking about except for me? I mean, I'm his favorite, right? You know, this is really the funny part of this story. And so he says, you know, somebody that you want to honor, I would say, put your crown on them, put your robe on them, get your best horse, get your best noble to lead them through the streets, and say, This is a man in whom the king delights in. This is somebody who's really, really great. And of course, what Mordecai's doing there is he says, this way, everybody will see me on that horse. They'll get used to seeing me with this crown. They'll get used to seeing me this. And so when I take over, I'll sail right in. This is what Haman is intending to do. And here's the best part of this whole story. The king says, you know what, Haman? I knew I had you around for a reason. That's the best idea. That's better than anything I could come up with. Go and do that for Mordecai. And so what does Haman have to do, right? You know, Haman, you know, he's very sorrowful. You know, he has to go and do this. And so they spend the entire day. Haman walks up and down the streets of the city, you know, saying, this is a man whom the Lord, you know, whom the king delights in. Mordecai. You know, I mean, but you see how God will take care of the wicked? You don't have to take care of the wicked. You don't need to be vindictive. You don't need to get even with anybody. Let God handle it. He is so much better at it. Okay? He really is good. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. I will repay. He really will. And so here's Mordecai. He's been honored. And now it's the end of the day, and Haman, you know, puts the horse away in the stable, and now he's going home. He says, all I want to do now is just go sit in my den and have a stiff drink and just forget this day. And that's when the people show up from the palace saying, you've got an appointment. You need to get down to the palace. And this time, Haman's starting to feel, things aren't going so well here. He's filled with some fear, right? And his wife, who isn't in help, says, well, if you start to fall before the king, you're not going to stop. So, great. Because remember, in his backyard, he's got this gallows with Mordecai's name on it, right? And he just honored Mordecai. So he knows he's on touchy ground. Anyway, they go and have this feast as you continue on in the story. And this time, God lets the queen know it's time now to tell the king what's going on. So she confesses it. She says, King, what I'm asking for is I'm asking for my life. I want you to grant me my life. I want you to save my life and the life of my people. And I says, you know, if we were just going to be enslaved or something like that, we would have done it, you know, but we're to be extinguished. And the king is like, who would dare to kill you, my beautiful, sweet, lovely wife? Who would dare to do that? And that's when she says, it's that evil, wicked Haman, right? And that's when the king began to understand all this plotting that's been going on. So he goes outside to think about it. Here he is, his supposed best friend, his right-hand man, is plotting against his own queen and against Mordecai, right? Because it was figured out, you know, Mordecai's a Jew. And so he, and at this point, the weasel Haman falls on the couch at the feet of the queen and begs for his life. That snake, that, you know. Yeah, but that's what it is. These people out here right now who are talking all this smack, if the roles were reversed, they'd be begging for their life. I mean, that's just, you got to feel sorry for them. You got to pity those who are consumed with evil, okay? Because it's a sad state. But anyway, the king comes in, and I think the king kind of figured out what he was going to do anyway. He says, are you going to try to force yourself in front of me? So they grabbed him, and one of the guys said that Mordecai has built a gallows, you know, to hang... Haman built a gallows to hang Mordecai on, and the king says, go put Haman up there. And so he did. So Haman was, you've heard the term, hoisted on your own petard. Well, that is basically based on this, because when, you know, he was impaled, and he was like crucified. I mean, he was nailed to that thing, and his dead body was up there. Okay. So, you know, what happens is, Esther tells the king that she's a Jew, and she tells him that Mordecai is my cousin, but he's my, you know, my father for all intents. And the king says, great, I've got an opening. Okay, you know, I've got a job for prime minister. Do you want it? He says, yeah, I'll take it. So he became the one that was in charge. Notice, that happened to Joseph, right? It happened to Daniel. Okay. And now it's happened to Mordecai. Isn't that cool? God will take care of us. If we'll do what's right, God will elevate us in due time if he has something for us to do. And so, but we still have this problem of the date, right? I mean, Haman's been taken care of, but we still have this proclamation that we've got to get rid of, and we can't change it, right? It's the law of the Medes and the Persians. You can't change this. On the 13th day of the 12th month of this year, it's going to be open season on the Jews. And so what the king says is, I want you guys to do whatever you think is right and best. You use your judgment. And so what they did was they came up with another proclamation. And the second proclamation said that on the 13th day of the 12th month of this year, the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. And they can kill anybody who's trying to kill them. Okay? And Mordecai published that throughout the land. And God again moved through that. A lot of people converted to Judaism, and they were very favorable towards it. So that when this date finally came, It was a rout. Thousands and thousands of enemies were put to death. Not a single Jew lost his life. In fact, the 10 sons of Haman were killed and hung up there where Haman had been. And there was a second day that was added to it to actually wipe out some more of it. In other words, there was this great conspiracy that had gone through the land, and God turned the tables and actually cleaned it up. Now, I told you all that story for this, and there's more in the story, but you can see, basically, they ended this by having a day of gifts and feasting. To celebrate the blessings of God, to celebrate the victory, the way that God had moved behind the scenes and kept them safe and took sorrow and brought it to joy through His providence, right? God is clearly doing all this stuff, right? They had a day of feasting. They had a day of celebration. They sent gifts to one another. They rejoiced. They helped the poor. They fed and they ate. And that was the beginning of the Jewish Thanksgiving, which we call Purim. But you can see the lesson really is far better than that. With this, I'll close. I appreciate your kind attention. I've actually gone quite long. But I want you to understand that the same God who did all this stuff back in the days of Xerxes the Great, is still around. Nothing's changed. God is doing this same thing in your life. You just don't see it. You can't see it until it comes to pass. But I do encourage you to continue to trust God, place your faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, do the things that you know to do. You don't have to see the full path. Just do whatever needs to be done today and let God bring about the rest. That's why we as a nation celebrate Thanksgiving, because God in many ways and many times in years past has blessed us as a nation. And we need to continue to bless Him, because He most certainly will if we ask Him. Thank you for your kind attention. May God bless you all. Hope you've had a wonderful Thanksgiving season.